So let's start. First, you know, it's great that that you figured out a Hamiltonian. It's great that you figured out that with the Hamiltonian that I gave you, if you're trying to create it from the dipolar coupling with just microwave pulses, that you would needed to address spins individually. And I want to explore a little bit more about this. The first thing that I haven't spent enough time to figure out yet is the Hamiltonian that you wrote down. So there's a family of Hamiltonians that are all related by a gauge. And you know, you can imagine that I could take that ring and I could thread a flux through there, and that the dynamic should be independent of that. And you can also see that simply by there's a set of non-trivial phases you can add to the Hamiltonian. But I don't think that the set of non-trivial phases I was adding encompass the Hamiltonian you wrote down. And so I wonder, you know, if this is part of that same gauge set, or if in fact it's a different class of solutions. So that I find that interesting, and I'll have to look at it. I want to, as you're, you know, we're going to continue with this problem. So I want to put down a few things. One is, as you think about the dipolar Hamiltonian in this case, remember that the orientation of the field matters. And so, for instance, if the field is pointing out to the board, then the dipolar coupling between each of the spin pairs is exactly the same. But if the field is pointing into the board, then they're different. And of course, if the field is pointing along this direction, then this dipolar coupling would be strong. Those two would be weaker, right? And you could even point in directions to cause one of the dipolar couplings to be zero. Yeah?
Why is the case that the magnetic field pointing directly out of the board
different
from the magnetic field pointing directly to the board?
It's not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, so, maybe I misspoke somewhere. Oh, okay. What I had meant to say was, you know, out of the board is all the dipolar couplings are the same. If it's in the plane of the board, then it matters what the orientation is. Good. The other place that I find interesting to think about is if I put another spin in the middle, in particular, if this spin is a different nuclear species. And okay, so if we're talking about boron nitride, then we say, oh, this is nitrogen and these are borons. Then there's a ZZ coupling. And of course, your ZZ coupling looks like you can add a phase with it. So you could create a Hamiltonian over this four-spin space. And then think about, well, what is the effective Hamiltonian over the three-spin space? And there, you can also use the direction of the magnetic field as another parameter. So there's an awful lot one can do with that. Now, I wanted to show you a different pulse sequence and to get you to think about other pieces. And in the case that we have three spins and only three spins, there becomes a nice nice isomorphism. That if I look at Hamiltonians of those two forms. So this is the one we're used to, the flip-flop Hamiltonian. This one is sometimes called the flip-flip Hamiltonian, but somehow I don't like that language. But this one, of course, what it does is it creates coherence between spins, provided that they're pointed in the same direction. As this one, of course, wants to have spins pointing in opposite directions. And because we only have two spins up and one spin down, then the dynamics under these look very similar. That the partitioning of space will be the same. The eigenmodes will be different in relatively trivial ways. And as you saw, this becomes difficult to create. And the reason it's difficult to create is that if I look at the piece sigma z in the dipolar Hamiltonian, it transforms in exactly the way sigma plus sigma minus sigma plus transforms. And so since they transform in the same way, there isn't a simple global rotation that'll separate them. And therefore, to separate these two exactly as you saw in the tutorial, you would have to distinguish the two spins. Over here, of course, this term, right now, we're plus, plus, and minus, minus. So if we wrote down the Hilbert space from the corners of the Hilbert space, these terms transform differently. And so then we know that we can create a sequence, a pulse sequence, that only keeps this term. And we can write one down. Let me get my phases right. So if I look at this sequence of just four pulses that are exactly the same, but with this timing, and I say, well, how does the piece of the dipolar Hamiltonian at sigma z evolve? Because remember, the dipolar Hamiltonian has these two pieces, sigma dot sigma, which is going to be unchanged under any pulse, and the piece sigma z, which is going to change. And so here, of course, we still have sigma z. In this case, we have sigma y. Here we have sigma z, sigma y, and sigma z. And so if we looked at the average of the dipolar Hamiltonian over this, well, it's going to go as, we'll just write down the spin dependence. So it's 1 over 6 tau. And then sigma dot sigma is always there. And plus we have, so it's minus 3, right? The dipolar Hamiltonian was minus 3 sigma z. So it's minus 3 times, what do we have here? We have 2 tau sigma z, and plus 4 tau sigma y. And so then if I look at this whole thing, we get sigma x plus sigma y plus sigma z minus sigma z plus minus 2 sigma y sigma y. And so we get sigma x minus sigma y And if you expand this out in terms of raising lowering operators, you get exactly that. No, I get this one. And so that's the nice thing, is that here, this one, I couldn't get this from a pulse sequence like this without adding this term as well, but I can get this term. And because we have this nice spin dependence of only having three spins and only being concerned with what happens in the single excitation manifolds, then it turns out that this Hamiltonian is just as good as that one. And you know, this one, you know, I start with because it's easy to describe the physics, right? You know, it really makes sense if we're talking transport to talk over here. But then for exactly the reasons you found, this one becomes a nicer sequence to build an experiment out of. And though, don't get too carried away, because just modifying the spin system a little bit and placing it in the right magnetic field, you have a lot of flexibility there too, right? And so, and then it is a trivial thing to show that if I change the phases of all of the pulses by 90 degrees, so if I put them along y instead of x, and I don't do anything else to the sequence, now you can see what's going to happen. If I change that, the only thing I'm going to do is I'm going to change these to x's. If I change these to x's, the only thing I'm going to do over here is I'm going to change that to x and that to y. And so I'll end up having the negative of that Hamiltonian. So this Hamiltonian will give me an effective dipolar Hamiltonian that looks like minus that. And that's a really nice thing to have. Because even if I have a multi-body problem, if I can run a Hamiltonian forward, and I can change its sign, and I can run it backwards, then I have to end up right where I started off. So provided you can change the sign of the entire Hamiltonian, then of course that's like you've changed the sign of time, and you should run backwards. And in fact, we do. We do that. You can do that very experimentally very well. Okay. Now, good. So now what I would like you to do for the next tutorial is you have this spin system. You've seen that you can engineer a Hamiltonian to drive it into these interesting states where you have transport, spin transport around the edge of that. And I'd like you first to think about what are interesting questions. What would you like to learn about that experimentally? And here, I'm not trying to encourage you to go back and read about quantum materials and Chern numbers and Mariana fermions. All of those things you could motivate the discussion from. But You know, it's there's too much there, and so the you know the question becomes more personal. If you're given the system, so I've given it to you, what would you particularly like to learn? And then I would like to say, you know, why that would be interesting to you, not. You know, you're not trying to write a Nature article. And how would you set up an experiment to study it? And I want to give you an example of that. An example is to say, imagine you have a lattice of spins. So we'll take a lattice of spins, etc. And that we wanted to understand how the coherence scaled. So as if I was looking at a large number of spins, would they decohere faster than if I was looking at a small number of spins? And then, you know, we need to say, well, what do I mean by looking at a large number of spins or looking at a small number of spins? Because at the end of the day, in the spectrometer, I have Avogadro's number of spins, right? So we want to say, okay, what do we mean? So let's ask the question of the coherence time. Versus number of spins. And I'm going to use these two Hamiltonians to define what I mean by number of spins. And when we looked at the equilibrium state on Monday, what we said was that the Zeeman interaction, which polarizes the spins, is very weak. And so that if we were at room temperature, only about one spin in 10 to the 5 is polarized. And so then I could say, well, the equilibrium density matrix looks something like this. I've got a bunch of spins. And they're mostly in the identity state, except occasionally one spin will be polarized. And of course, you know, there's no right to say which spin is polarized. Okay, so we just have a slew of states that look like this. There'll be many, 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 many of these. Yeah? And so we just say, oh yeah, there's a little bit of polarization somewhere. And I want to draw a picture for you. I'm going to draw a picture with two axes. And this axis, I'm going to call the spin number. And I'll describe that. And this axis, I'm going to call a coherence number. And the coherence number has some relationship with Hamming weights, but let's define it easily as saying if I apply an operator, yeah, that was correct. And what I mean by this sum is that each of those, of course, live in the full Hilbert space, each operator. So they're tensored with identity, to enough copies of the identity to give me an operator in that full space. But the ith term has sigma z in it. And if I apply this operator to some state, then this state is going to pick up a phase shift of n times phi. And we're to call this n the coherence number. And I'll remind you that if I look at, well, first, of course, if I look at the commutator of z with z or identity with z, they commute, so that's boring. So I won't write it down. Don't do that. So that the commutator of sigma z with the raising and lowering operator just counts the number of raising and lowering operators. So that if I had a state that had n, well, let's say that it had k sigma pluses and l sigma minuses, and I applied this operator, then the number of phase shifts I would get is k minus l. Right, just counts. Okay, so here, I'm going to start with having one spin, and so this will also look like the Pauli weight, if you've seen that. But it just counts the number of Pauli operators that are not identity. And so if I start off with this state, then it has coherence zero because sigma z commutes with that propagator. And it has spin number one because there's only one Pauli which is not equal to the identity. If I apply Hamiltonian of this form, then it increases the spin number by one. I should say it changes. And it changes the coherence number by plus or minus 2. But of course, the coherence number must be less than the spin number, right? So if we start off at this point and I apply this operator, then what's going to happen? Well, I'll be able to go from 1 on the spin number to plus or minus 2 on the coherence number, right? So we'll be able to make that transition. And we can write these down, right? If this state was sigma z, this state is sigma plus, and this state is sigma minus. It'll transform that way. Now, if I apply it again, well, again, we can change the coherence number by plus or minus 2, but I only have spin number of 2, so I can't go to 4. And so what will happen is we'll go back to 0. That's the only place you can go. But it gets more interesting if I continue. So this was 1, 2, 3, 4. So now we're at 5. And at 5, of course, we can have a spin number of 4. I mean a coherence number of 4, sorry. And so we keep growing out in this way. And so here we have a state which is going to transform like so. And as we continue, you know, we'll always have this structure. Etc. And when you run this in a solid sample, and you say, well, how far out can you get on this axis? You can get out to thousands. So you can take a sample, and you can have a coherent superposition of thousands of spins. We want to be able to prove that. So I wanted to set up an experiment. I want to set up an experiment where, remember, I want to measure the coherence time. And here I can say, well, I want to create a large coherence. I want to go out on this axis as far as I can. And then I want to measure the relaxation time. I want to measure how long that is coherent. So I think you would tell me that what you should do is take this Hamiltonian and apply it for some time so that we're going far out there on that axis. And then I want to have a time where I wait because I want to measure the decoherence of those states. So if I want to measure the decoherence, I need to wait for some time. And then I'm going to need to come back because I can't measure those states separately. I can only measure states like this. So I wanted to go out, let them decohere, and come back. And during this time, well, I don't want to see the dipolar interaction of the spins, right? Then they would do lots of crazy things. So during this time, I would like you to be mostly the identity. I want to do everything I can to prevent the system from evolving. Now, we saw that. You saw that you could take the dipolar Hamiltonian, you could make it zero. So we said, okay, during this time, we're going to run an experiment where HD is equal to zero. So we have to do a lot to do that. And we'll call a time here. And here, I'm going to make a measurement. And here, we're starting with the thermal state. All right. Now all that is easy, if perhaps a bit too fast. Now I want to do something which is tricky. Over here, we said, if I could apply this operation, then the coherence at n would pick up n times a phase. The coherence at n minus 1 would pick up n minus 1 times the phase. And so I have an opportunity to label those phases, to label those coherences by a phase. And so during this time, I can say, well, I want everything to be the same, except I also want to add in this piece that says, I have phase sum sigma z sub I. I just want to add in a small phase shift so that I know that if I was, let me come back over here, that if I was over here, this whole column would pick up a phase of twice phi. And this column we'd pick up a phase of 4 times phi, et cetera, as I keep going out, right? Yeah, please. It is the definition of the coherence number, and it gives me a recipe for how to label it all at the same time.
That's what coherence means.
Okay, let me see if I can answer that question. Let's take 4 spins. And so if I have 4 spins, then there's an energy level diagram so it's just the Zeeman energy, right? And of course at the fringes there's only one way for all the spins to be up or down. If I have 1 spin flipped, there's 4 ways. And if I have 2 spins flipped, there are more ways. 4 take 2. And if I have 2 spins flipped, there's more ways. Right? And so then I have this manifold of states. And we would say, well, I have a coherence if I have a coherent superposition between any of these two. And now we're taking a coarse-grained look at that. We're saying, okay, if I have a coherence between any of these levels separated by an energy, and all of these are spaced by the same energy, then I'll call that a coherence number of 1. And if I have something that looks like this, 2, 3, and then 4, and of course there's only one way of getting a coherence order of number of 4. Yeah?
Okay.
Good. And so now then I can say, okay, I can look at this evolution and the state that I'm going to end up with here. Well, the state will always be just sigma z on one of the spins, right? Because we started with there. And we did the experiment correctly, so we went out and created these large coherences, labeled them, and came back. Everything commutes with it, with each other. Life is great. We end up with sigma z, labeled by e to the I times coherence number of phi. And of course, if we have Avogadro's number of spins, there'll be lots of different coherence numbers. Now, I want to do 2 things here. One, we're going to increment this time. Because that allows us to measure a T2, a coherence time of of the coherence number. But I'm also going to increment this phase. Because if I increment the phase, then when I collect this data, then I can take the Fourier transform with respect to the phase. If I take the Fourier transform with respect to the phase, it'll return a delta function of the coherence number. So let's write out the whole thing. So now this the signal that we get is going to be sigma z e to the I coherence number times the phase. It will be e to the minus t, the time up there, divided by t2 of that coherence number. And of course, there'll be a probability that we've created that coherence number, which, you know, comes out to this unitary dynamics here, right? So we could calculate that, but it's a multi-body problem, so we can't calculate it. And this will be integrated, and we're going to integrate this over all coherence numbers. And then I can take this data set, which is now a data set. So let me put phi here, right? I've got both of those times. And then I take the Fourier transform of this with respect to that. So the Fourier transform of S of t of phi equal to now the integral just call it a frequency. Doesn't make any difference. And what we'll extract? We'll extract when those two give us a delta function. So we'll get out of this a spectrum of delta functions just at the coherence numbers. And then I can fit those to a Lorentzian, and I can see what the coherence number looks like. And when we do all that, what do we find? So if I measure T2 versus coherence number versus coherence number, well, we could think before we did the experiment, we say, well, if it was flat, you know, that would be really, really good. And that would say that, you know, nothing is happening, right? That the coherence is independent of the size of the number of particles. Be very surprising if that was the case. Or we could say, well, it would fall off as 1 over the number of particles. And then we would say, oh, well, okay, that's all right. It says that the noise acts independently. And that's the model we normally use in thinking about quantum systems. But, you know, this is a small quantum system, right? Those spins are only an angstrom apart. And, you know, what's the noise? Usually the biggest noise is some cement truck going by or a train. And so it'd be surprising if two spins that are an angstrom apart would see the train differently. And so then, maybe it falls off as 1 over the square that says, okay, there's a collective behavior of noise. What is it happens? Well, it falls off like that experimentally. And it starts off looking bad. And then after some point, and it's hard to tell how flat that really is. After some point, it looks really good. It looks like, well, if you made a big enough quantum processor, decoherence would leave you alone. And, you know, if you want to really lame theories about that, you could say, oh, well, decoherence can only touch the edges of your processor. You know, these are spins. So why is the magnetic field only getting to the edge of my spins and not the center? You know, that would be a nice material to have, and it's not the one I do have. So we can come up with bad stories, but so far not yet good physics. But it looks great, right? It says, all you need to do to make your quantum computer work is you need to make it big enough. If you make it big enough, nature will conspire with you, and everything will be fine. And we've just been too modest in starting off with small quantum computers. Okay, so there is my example of a problem where we took a nice problem, we could describe what we wanted to learn from it, set it up in an experiment, say, what do we start with? What does this experiment look like? What do we measure? And sketch it out in really rough steps. And that's what I'd like you to do with these spins on a ring, to come up with a question. And of course, you know, it's nice to think about this. It's, you know, the more interesting the question you come up with, the easier it is to put some energy into figuring out if you can answer it. And then to say, without going into the details, but just as a rough sketch, how would you set up to answer that question? And you can see that perhaps the answer wouldn't be everything you'd wanted. Over here, we're measuring the coherence, the decay in these columns, right? And you might say, well, I really want to know, is this one more coherent than that one? Is more coherent than that one, right? It might be that you would want to measure every element of that, except it's one, we don't know how to do it, and if we did, it would still be pretty painful to do. Fundamental reason is we don't know how to do it, therefore we say, well, it'd be too painful. So you know, we start off with one story, and we end up at the end modifying it a little bit because this is what, in fact, we can do. And we end up having what is a nice problem. And of course, the results are revealing too, that, you know, before we do this, people would say, well, look, if it's this curve, quantum error correction takes care of it. If it's this curve, well, then you have some correlated effects, and if their correlated effects are graceful, quantum error correction will be even better. You know? And they would say, you're never going to get anything else, so there's no point in doing the experiment. Just build your quantum computer. But now you find something, you know, new and interesting. Okay, good. So that's what you'll do on Thursday. Without me telling you any ideas of what you'll actually do. Good. Okay. In the 2 minutes left, I should teach this course so that my preambles don't count towards the lecture. And then we could get further. So remember what we had going back two classes ago. We had a term which was the Zeeman Hamiltonian. And then we're going to add to the Zeeman Hamiltonian an RF Hamiltonian, which I'm going to write in this really clunky way. And the reason I'm going to write it in that clunky way is we have our magnetic field be zero. And we saw that if we wanted to rotate the spins from Z, right? The spins want to be along Z. That's the energy axis. Then, of course, I need to have a field which is perpendicular to it. So we're going to have a B1 field that's perpendicular to that. And the field needs to oscillate because the spins are processing about here, the field needs to act in step with the spins in order to have any integrated effect. And so what we end up doing is putting a small coil here and having an alternating field in that small coil. And so that's exactly what I've written there, saying that that's the x-axis, and that here I would apply a voltage that would be cosine omega t of t. Okay, so we have this alternating field. And remember also that this is really, really small. That in order to create that field, we have a superconducting magnet. It's so big, it weighs 600 pounds, and is energized with about 100 amps of current, and it has an inductance of about 60 Henry. And so there's a lot of power, stored energy there. Here, this is going to represent, and this will end up representing about tens of thousands of Gauss. This will represent a couple Gauss. So it's a much, much smaller field. And the coil will be a coil that you would wrap by hand four turns around a pencil, something like that. Okay. So now we have this field. And it's alternating because physically it's alternating. And then we said, well, we can decompose into a rotating and a counter-rotating field. And so then I can say, well, I'm going to take this field, and I'm going to look at it like that. Yeah.
A particular reason why you give me 2 omega 1 over.
Yeah, there is. Don't steal my thunder. I'll come to it. So we have those two fields, and you can see that they're rotating in opposite directions. So in one case, we'll take sigma x towards sigma y. In the other case, we'll take sigma x towards minus sigma y. And I don't promise that I didn't get those two backwards, okay? But they'll be different anyways. You can tell by the sign. And so we have two fields. And of course, we have this omega here. And only one of them is going to be interesting. So the reason that I have this two here is we're ending up having both of these. I'll have to divide by two. And so I'll end up with omega one divided by two in front of both of those. Right? And remember that this two shows up, I keep it because of I'm using poly operators. This two shows up because at the end of the day I want the strength of the nutating field to be proportional to omega one, not twice omega one. All right. Good. So now then we have this rotating field. And it looks a little bit nicer, right? Because the spins are rotating, the field is rotating. We can say, oh yeah, they should see some collective evolution. But it becomes a drag, because if I do the calculation now, I need to keep track of the rotation. I don't want to keep track of the rotation. So I want to move into an interaction frame. And I'm going to move to an interaction frame that's defined by this frequency. And the reason for that is the spins could have lots of different frequencies. In fact, at the end of the day, I may have many, many different spins, each with their own frequency in the system. But that frequency over there, well, that's controlled by a synthesizer. There's a knob somewhere I rotate and set that frequency. So as an experimentalist, I like to pick my interaction frame based upon something I control, which is that synthesizer. So we're going to create an interaction frame. We're going to define an interaction frame that we're going to look at. And so then I can say that rho tilde is equal to rho transformed into this frame. Yeah. And we, of course, know that the time derivative of the evolution of the density matrix is given by the commutator. So let's look at the derivative of the density matrix in this interaction frame. And so then we can take and expand that term. Like so. And now I simply need to remember that the derivative of the unitary, of course, is going to be the Hamiltonian of the system. And since we've written it in this nice way, then we can say that the Hamiltonian for this interaction frame, the Hamiltonian that takes us into this interaction frame, looks like that. And of course, when I take the time derivative of the inverse, the Hamiltonian just picks up a negative sign, right? And the derivative of this is given by Schrodinger's equation. Stick it all together. And we end up with a familiar result, I hope. Where I have the total Hamiltonian in the transformed frame, the minus the Hamiltonian that took me to that transformed frame, and of course the density matrix in that transformed frame. And let me ask, you've all gone through this, right? Yeah, so if by chance you haven't, write it out. But and so what does that mean? We go to a state that looks like omega naught minus omega t over 2, right? Because omega t was our transforming frame. Still about sigma z. Here, we're going to transform this. And you can see that, this looks like you. We're in good shape, right? Because that's going to vanish. So there'll be one term that is omega 1 over 2 sigma x. And then there'll be another term where, we're in bad shape, right? Because now we've taken the counter-rotating frame. The counter-rotating field, we've made it twice as fast. Okay? And of course, we've made no assumptions, right? Everything is right. We haven't dropped anything yet. Yeah? And so we end up with this nice Hamiltonian in the so-called rotating frame. Because in fact, we got there by rotating. And then we have this quickly rotating piece. And this one we drop. That's the rotating frame approximation. To set that one equal to zero. And it's a simple problem to calculate, well, how important is it? How big an error have you made? And that problem, although it's not usually recognized that way, that problem was first solved by Bloch and Siegert. So the same Bloch in a very early paper. And he shows that if you include this, you pick up a small error here. And the error is of size the angle between the original, between these two original vectors, if I took that to be a constant, to be one, right? So it'll be a small angle that says, hey, here's omega 1, omega 0. Here's omega 1. There'll be that angle. It's that angle times the ratio of those two fields. And so it shows up as a second order effect. And it is tiny, tiny, tiny. Okay. So then we've defined the dynamics. And what we'll do is we'll pick up from there on Thursday, tomorrow. And we'll look at the Bloch equations now when we add this term to the system. Any questions? Okay. So think about the spin current in a loop. And if you want to bounce ideas off me, you know, we can do that tomorrow as well. And then tomorrow, of course, we'll have two lectures.